Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of BFE. And today's guest is one of those individuals I just look at and just be like, okay, I want to be like you when I grow up. So let me just tell you what happened and what I mean by what I want to be like you when I grow up. She is absolutely brilliant, a genius. So we're at an AI symposium in Albany. And Rebecca, we first see each other within the first 5 minutes. She was like, you got some time? I want to show you something. And when Rebecca said, you got some time, I want to show you something, that means you're going to learn something. And literally for about 45 minutes, Rebecca is unpacking the new ChatGPT for and showing me all these different variations in the platform. And I'm sitting there like, okay, first, I don't have my notebook. Second, I'm trying to store everything that Rebecca's saying in the notes of my old iPhone. And third, just absolutely enamored on the depth of knowledge that Rebecca brings into this AI vertical that we talk about with education. And Rebecca Baltima is just somebody that I just absolutely look up to and just admire her work and unpack her work surgically in the context of how I can be able to build on my individual practices as well as strengthen nodes and elements within my organization and ed tech company. So I want to welcome, and I know she's going to be mad at me when I say this, the Rebecca Baltima.
Oh, I am so happy to be here, Michael. You neglected to mention that we had that conversation at a party, a social event, because I am a huge nerd who just can't turn it on and off. And so we were like at a social event. This wasn't just like at a conference. Everybody else was having fun and I was nerding out and forcing Michael to nerd out with me.
Rebecca, literally to my audience, it was really a social event, networking event that when, you know, you see two academics, two intellects come together, Rebecca's like, I got to show you something. You got a few minutes? And I automatically knew with that. And also Rebecca, domestic, international AI expert. She's an expert in various nodes, various elements, or I should say rudiments within the whole education ecosystem, whether it be around policy, whether it be around governance, specifically ethics, where we're going to unpack it. She is one of those rooted czars in the ecosystem. She is out of Alberta, Canada. So not only just internationally renowned, she's also renowned here in the United States. So Rebecca, you know, selfishly, I want to be able to reincarnate that conversation for our audience and go even deeper, because again, I think the level of expertise that you have in AI and being a czar in a variety of different tenets in this ecosystem, in the AI operating model, I think that this will be a great professional learning experience for my audience with you. So Rebecca, welcome to VFE.
Oh, what an intro. I appreciate that so much, Michael. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. Excited to have you. Excited to, like I say, unpack your IP so that my audience will be able to apply strategies in this sophisticated and strategic context for better outcomes and systems for our students. But you, Rebecca, focusing on you as an international keynote speaker, focusing on AI, expert in the policy vertical, as I stated at the outset, this czar from this broader AI type of landscape. For my audience members of VFE, what do they not know about Miss Rebecca Baltima? And what song describes your work in the education ecosphere?
You know, I've actually been thinking about this because I have what might be considered an unexpected taste in music. So I'm actually a huge Kendrick Lamar fan. And so the song that I picked for this was, I had to decide between a couple, so I just picked them both. I picked Not Like Us just because I spend a lot of my time helping in the ethics research that I do, organizations and people figure out that, like, no matter how advanced and cool and bright and shiny AI is, it's not like us. It is like us, but it can outperform us on certain tasks, and it can give us the illusion of understanding us and the illusion of empathy, but they're not like us. There's things that need to be authentically human. And so just kind of like how Kendrick's calling out authenticity and artificial behavior, that's kind of what I do in AI ethics. I'm always asking or having people ask, what's real? What's authentic? What's uniquely human that we need to protect? And I guess also Humble by Kendrick Lamar, because it kind of speaks to the power paradox that I think about and talk about a lot. And we just always need to be checking ourselves. And I mean, really, that whole album was about duality and weakness and strength and pride and humility and all of these paradoxes. And we just need to recognize, and this is something I struggle with daily, this paradox between this technology is incredibly powerful, but we are incredibly vulnerable to the harm that it might cause to us as individuals and as a society. So we just kind of need to be humble in the face of this technology too, I think, and go in with our eyes wide open. So if anyone's watching this visually, they'll realize how weird that is, because I'm like a, I don't know, mid-40s, like suburban soccer mom, you know, has been blasting, I don't know, rap music since 1994. But yeah, I tried to come up with something that might be a little more on brand, but I had nothing. So Kendrick it is.
I respect the choice, right? Because I will never forget this, Rebecca. I was at a social event, and you know, most people, they see Dr. Michael Connor.
Yes, they do. With the great socks, the great shoes. Yeah. Polish.
Polished, Rebecca. Absolutely right. And then a rap song comes on and I start singing it, you know, really word for word. And people are looking at me. I'm like, well, you know, there is an aspect of Mike or Michael, but I love the choice. Kendrick Lamar, specifically Not Like Us. He's to me one of the greatest lyricists that are out there. Just a poetic genius. But I loved how you had this association and even this interdependent dynamic of how Not Like Us, where AI is not like us. I love that association, because there's always going to be, no matter what time frame that we're in, specifically you and I, we were talking about 2035 at the AI symposium, really looking at these future designs, talking about how now models can self-correct themselves, but there's always going to have that human element in it. And I always like to reference Moore's Law when we talk about this equilibrium between humans and machines. I think that there's that equivalency that lives in education with AI, leader, practitioner, classroom practitioner, when we think about that. And then that power paradox, and using the song Humble. That's woo. If I have more time, I would want to get in your genius of a brain to unpack Humble and with threads of AI. But there is, I think, this paradox that we are experiencing. And I think this paradox is multi-tenant, it's multi-nuanced, and it needs that level of this kind of experimentation, continuous level of experimentation, to be able to now navigate through, I think, this inevitable paradox we're going to continuously to live in education, specifically now, these tenets of how technology and AI are proving themselves and being this meta-ruptor, not just a disruptor, but a meta-ruptor in the model. But Rebecca, your expertise is just not limited to these defined areas. But just for this question, I just want to just focus, or I just want to narrow the focus on AI strategy and AI ethics, right? So from your perspective, how do we efficiently intersect AI strategy and ethics in our learning organizations or in our ministries, governance structures, and even from a board or trustee member? How do we have that intersectionality with this triangulation with that? And then also the second part of this, how do we underscore policy to impact classrooms and instruction to be future driven, just not the complicit standardized policy language around AI integration and classroom instruction, but how do we now make our classes to be future driven?
I love that you use the word ministry, actually, because we all really are in positions of servitude, right? Like, I've never heard it used in that context in a leadership role, and I love it. It throws me back to servant leadership. I've been thinking about this one thing that I kind of, well, first of all, here's how I think about it. I think about it like strategy is our destination and AI is the vehicle, but ethics is the seatbelt that we wear because we can't just floor it. We all have to arrive there safely together. And I actually, I have four kids who are, you know, 20, 21, 22, 23. And they use the Gen Z slang a lot. And I actually kind of adapted one of their phrases that was my favorite, which is, you know, the vibes. The vibes are off. The vibes are immaculate. But this vibe framework, I thought about it because this generation makes every decision kind of based on vibes, right? Like, oh, this place has good vibes. Oh, the vibes were off. I broke up with her. And they can kind of sense authenticity or the lack thereof. They can't maybe articulate it, but they can sense it. So this vibe framework is making AI like visible, intentional, beneficial, and earned. So visible means not hiding, using AI out in the open, especially in education, like when you're using AI for something or not even in education, make it visible. Like students, parents, publics kind of need to know how it's being used. I think it needs to be visible, intentional, right? With purpose. We need to be using it as part of our strategy, not even ed tech, right? We didn't buy this because they had a good sales pitch. How are we intentionally going to use this technology in this way? Beneficial is the, you know, the equity check. Does it help everybody, all students? Is there people who are being left behind or being harmed? And earned, because trust isn't given. It's proven through consistent actions. And if you mess up, you own it. If you succeed, share it. But everything that we do, like, we just need to make it a vibe, right? Like with AI, make it part of the conversation, not like a checklist, but just give it the vibe check. Really, that's how I think about it. Ethics and ethics without strategy is mostly just like philosophy, right? And strategy without ethics is just kind of dangerous. So we just have to be really cautious as we implement this to make sure that, you know, everybody arrives at the destination safely.
Absolutely, Rebecca. I love the analogy where you had ethics as a seatbelt at the end. When I thought about, or when you said that immediately, I thought of like, wow, that is ethics in itself, right? But the vibe framework, and it's funny that you talk about vibes, right? Because I got a Gen Air, Gen Alpha, who you met.
Yep.
And he, you know, when they talk about vibes, he incorporates vibes. And they think, what's the vibes? I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yep.
Right? Like, I'm like, the vibes, like, yeah, the vibes. I think the vibes feel good, right? Well, anyway, with that, but I love how you created that association and put it in a framework context. And you're so right, right? When you think about how can we create these everlasting vibes with AI in the classroom? I think one day, Rebecca, I don't know when, but AI is not going to be an intentional phrase that we have to use in every conversation. Right. When we talk about, oh, this is how we integrate AI into, it's needed now. We need the pretext. I get it. But 10, 20 years from now, it should be a part or naturalized into the culture of education. 10 years from now, where are we going to be at this benchmark of 2035 that we talk about? But Rebecca, knowing, and you know me as a person that architects around strategy, but I love how you said it. Strategy without ethics is very dangerous, and you're absolutely true with that. But when we think about economic patterns, right, and educational advancements, I always pay attention from this economist perspective on how we're able to, I like to say, disrupt or have these meta-ruptive approaches around integrating AI into the operating model. But what now? I know you are, Rebecca. Like I said, you're a czar with this, and I lean on you to find out information with regards to disruptive technologies, i.e., hey, you got a few moments? Let me show you this. That turned into a 500-level course in about 30 minutes that I love. But Rebecca, what are the most advanced forms of AI and disruptive technologies we should be having structured conversations around right now? Right. If I'm a leader today, what are those conversations I need to have? And then also, what type of professional learning should be implemented with this degree of consistency and integrity? Right. So that now these forms of disruptive technologies in education become lucid and seamless in the model.
You're opening the door here because I could talk about this stuff, you know, because I do. all the time. But I think, you know, like top of mind right now are these frontier models with advanced reasoning, especially because ChatGPT-5, at the time that we're recording this, it just came out. So OpenAI just launched their most powerful version of ChatGPT for everybody. Even the free tier has access to it. And to kind of match that, Anthropic's Claude, their number one competitor, released a similarly powerful model, Opus 4.1, and Grok, Elon Musk's company, released Grok 4. So these are extremely powerful, what we call frontier models, that can do amazing things. Honestly, it really is like having somebody with a PhD in every subject fully available to you 24/7. And so it has never been easier to think through every possible scenario, get deep research on a topic before you make important decisions, to have somebody push back against your ideas. That's one of the ways I like to use it. If I know I'm going to be making a decision or speaking to a group, I try to build a research persona of the group I'm speaking to and then have it pick apart my arguments or my delivery to see what I'm missing, right? So I think that's a key technology. That's the biggest one, top of mind, right? Like ChatGPT, these frontier models that are amazing and smart. But they also create outputs that are impossible to tell if they're real or fake, be that images or songs or writing. We need to be talking about what's called agentic AI, which are like AI agents, which everybody's talking about. And really, it's not as complicated as I think it sounds to regular people, because the idea of agents is just kind of confusing, I think. And there's autonomous agents already built into ChatGPT or Gemini. For example, when you and I were together at that party, I was showing you how to use AI to go out and do deep research on a topic, right? So if I was going to give a keynote at a particular event, let's say it's a company in the real estate sector in British Columbia, Canada, I would use ChatGPT-5 I would assign it a deep research project to go out and find out everything it could about this organization, its competitors, its historical, the perspective and perceptions of the company. And it will just go away and take 10 or 15 minutes and go everywhere on the internet and basically return me like a master's level thesis type paper with 150 sources. But it's going off to do that on its own while I do other things. And that's really what an agent is. The best example of this is Google just came out with a beta project called Google Opal. And really, it is the most basic way to do this for regular people. And you just tell it, hey, I want something that every time I ask it a question, it will go out, find the answer, transform it into explaining it at a fourth grade level in Microsoft analogies, and then make a website to help a kid understand it. All you have to do is then push a button. It builds it by you just talking to it, and it's kind of doing things in the background. That's all agents are. So if we build that for your son, let's say, he has it forever. Every piece of information he finds on the internet or gets from his teacher, he just puts in the background. It does all of that, makes sure it's semi-accurate, you know, whatever. So that's kind of how agents work. And then, so agents are one big thing that we need to be talking about. The other one is this idea of robotics and autonomous systems, which I'm not going to get into. It's a whole separate thing, but it's just the idea of we're putting this powerful technology into physical things, you know, beyond a Roomba, you know, something that can actually, and there's a lot of risk and benefits associated with that too. So those are kind of what we need to be keeping our eyes on, things like the latest AI models, you know, where agents are going to go and where the line's going to be between how much we trust them, and then what that looks like once it becomes embodied technology and how that might impact us.
Really good point. To my audience, and Rebecca, I use BFE as an asynchronous professional learning tool that a lot of my audience can be able to segment, rewind, go back, promulgate, challenge against their current practices, creative tension, Peter Senge's theory, as if we want to be explicit, but I really want to go into these agents, right? And the reason why I'm sounding a little disjointed with this, Rebecca, is because I was just talking about this form of AI, and I want you to be able to highlight what this AI is. And I'm forecasting, and again, this is my own personalized theory of action, value proposition, or even hypotheses, and people get challenges this when I say this, is that this new form of AI could really now traditionally or eliminate the traditional brick and mortars.
Potentially.
And if I'm thinking about how super intelligence, right, we're talking about these really new robust frontier models around how they're just improving simultaneously. We look at the data sets on the back, but this agent, this new level of AI, you said that there's a lot of risk and benefits. Me, that's a radical architect of education models. And I'm thinking that because of this, we can bring school one-to-one. Can you just elaborate? I know I might be way out, like people 10 years ago were saying, Mike, your thinking is way out there. This will never happen. And we're living it. I'm thinking this now. I'm getting the same responses that I got in 17 and 18. And when I talk about the 22nd century education model, when I talk about new designs, when I talk about new model implementations, we're seeing brick and mortars now and different verticals being eliminated, different industries being eliminated, Toys R Us being one of my favorite. Can this happen in education? I think it can, because if it's happening in the economy, it can be mirrored in education, but everybody kind of pushes me away when I say this new AI can really now radicalize how one-to-one instruction can be delivered. And let's be honest, with the exception of some nuances, these are the risks, it can get to the level of a zone of proximal development that you and I can't get with a student. But I just want to hear your thinking of this.
I think you're spot on, and people don't like to hear it. And you have to be very careful who you have these conversations around, because people are already scared. So we just have to like reimagine when we think about a school day, like the time we actually spend delivering instruction versus like character education and things like, you know, things that hobbies. People freaked out when there was this kind of AI school, this alpha school that kind of popped up in Arizona a couple of years ago. And their whole premise was, yeah, the kids are going to like learn with AI for maybe 2 hours. And the rest of the day, we're doing character education. They chase something they're passionate about. We help them do that. And I don't think we're that far off. If you think about it, if we would have told you even pre-AI, guess what? What if every kid could go home every night and have a personalized tutor who is endlessly patient and could help them understand things, meet them where they're at? Like, that would be the dream for kids. And for actually learning the content, that will be great. But there's so many other things that happen at school in terms of socialization and role modeling and developing character. Those things, I think we'll still need brick and mortar buildings for those. Maybe they just become repurposed into more like community building centers, and their purpose shifts. And, you know, people talk about flipped classrooms, but that idea that you kind of absorb the content at home and then you come back and you experience and you engage and all of those wonderfully human things that you can't necessarily do with the AI, I think that would be great. And we'll still need people to do that. But we probably won't need a teacher to 30, 40, 50 kids to explain things in one way. Or maybe the teacher does while kids are working with the AI to translate it into a way that makes sense for them and meets them as a learner. And I think that sounds amazing. But we just need to find a way to make sure that the people involved in the process are still equally valued and that kids get the exposure to the human elements of education that matter so, so much. But then they'll still have the opportunity to chase things that they're passionate about. And, you know, if you have a teacher who doesn't care at all about this thing that you care about, well, you can still learn other things from them, but you can still learn in the way that you learn best and using things you care about. It's probably a disjointed answer, but your short answer is yes, I think we end up with a one-to-one. I don't know if that will be the fully replace education as it is now model. I think it, like everything else, will land somewhere in the middle. But I think we can do it.
Absolutely. And Rebecca, I always, what they say, you aim for the moon and you'll get to the sun, right? Or something like, but I love, and yes, I agree with you, not 1,000%. Not 100,000%. I agree with you 1,000,000%. I always say, and people are like, how can you eliminate traditional schools. I'm like, I'm not saying we're going to eliminate the brick and mortar, but they will be repurposed that integrate these elements of AI where the shift of learning is not a traditional 7:30 to 2:30, not a traditional 180, but it is a repurposed environment where now articulated skills, articulated competencies, articulated what they call it, the distinct elements of talent from the Delta 2030 study, is that they get to be able to demonstrate that and exhibit that in the community, in this repurposed environment. Because no matter what, and one of my former professors from Harvard always says this, Kaleem Lakhani, he stated this when I was in the program, is that AI won't replace humans, but humans without AI will be replaced by humans with AI. But I want to extend on this, Rebecca, because I think you're hitting on to something now. Now with this notion, purposeful shifting, right? This purposeful shift or this repurposed redesign of our traditional structures that we see in education, that human element of it. I want you to do this because we're seeing these frontier models, these new agent AI models, super intelligence coming out, forms of AI that can now, you know, do logic and reasoning, which is scary in itself. With this notion, same level set that we were talking about, where do you see school being reauthorized or redefined? Specifically now, how are we challenging seat time, right? We always talk about seat time. How do we challenge academic calendars? How do we now challenge technological infrastructure in schools and in ministries? How do we now look at this in this unique way that we're talking about education, even if the traditional brick and mortar, traditional structures of schools, elements, rudiments of that will always be a part of the legacy in education?
So are we talking about what needs to change, or what does that look like in the future, or what needs to happen now for change?
Yeah, what does that look like in the future, Rebecca? Like, when we talk about seat time, what makes Rebecca Baltzma complete a course in 60 hours that you're going to master it, where shoot, Michael Connor might need 260 hours, right? How do we challenge seat time like that with AI now?
Well, you and I both know, and this is talk to death, but you know, that idea of traditional school, the schools we went to, which worked out great for us because we were obviously, you know, we fit well into that model, but that Industrial Revolution era with bells and grade summaries and summers off, which was basically for farming back then, and that 150-year-old operating system, obviously, that's not going to work for very much longer. We're trying so hard to make sure it still works, and so many people are holding onto their cold, dead hands. But I really think, you know, asking, what school does your kid go to, like, in 10 years from now, it'll be like asking, oh, you know, how many text messages are on your cell phone plan? You know, stuff that kids today just don't even understand. Do you remember when you had to pay per text message? And if you wanted like an E, you had to hit that three, like five times, you know. But I really think the idea of school will become more like a network and not a building necessarily. It's not a place you'll go. There'll be physical hubs for labs and for sports, for social connection. But I think school is your personalized AI learning companion that can go with you anywhere you go. Everything's school, as long as you're learning. And I already do this, right? As a student, my school is in Scotland, right? Where I do my research and my work, and I can go do my learning anywhere I go. But, you know, I think that that's going to become more the case, and people will be set up better to do that, because you couldn't do that before if your mom or dad weren't like prepared to help you. And now you'll have endless help. The idea of a teacher, instead of just being like a discipline manager and a logistics manager, it'll be more of like a learning architect, right? Like they're not going to be delivering content, because let's face it, like AI will be able to deliver content better and in any way that you want it. I'm an auditory learner and a verbal processor. So I like to listen to content and then have a conversation with AI and have it devil's advocate all of my ideas or poke holes. Like I like that back and forth. And a teacher can't do that with every student, right? So the teachers will become, but they will be important for teaching kids things like empathy, creativity, ethical reasoning, collaboration, modeling, all of those how to learn things and being a sense of support. The thing that always kind of gives me comfort is knowing that when I call Delta, no matter how good the AI is, I just want to talk to a person. I need an agent to solve my problem. And I think that that will still matter. I don't think we'll have standardized tests anymore. Thank goodness. I think maybe it'll be AI is assessing you continuously through projects and conversations and creation. And it'll know that you understand physics because you built something that works, not because you did ACDC on your multiple choice quiz test and got lucky that time, right? You know, I wonder what credentials will look like. You know, you and I are obviously big like degree people, right? But I wonder if it'll be less about taking that traditional path and checking that box that you graduated rather than mastering a portfolio of skills. And your portfolio gets maintained your whole life from 35 to 50. And it's just like a sense of being and becoming instead of reaching a destination. I know it sounds murky. Like you mentioned too, that 8 to 3 school day. I think learning will happen when you're ready. You know, there's all this research about teenagers. Like you'll know soon, but I know they struggle with those early morning classes, but they're great later on. And kids maybe will be able to, you know, I had a son who did his best math at 10 p.m. And now you have a system that's there all the time at 10 p.m. to help you. So it'll just become as personalized as their Spotify playlist. And I think the idea of classroom management maybe becomes irrelevant. I think a lot of behavior problems we have are because kids are bored, you know, and I think that we lose a lot of that with personalized pacing and engagement and kids not being as frustrated because they're lost or they can't keep up or they feel dumb. Maybe once we get rid of all of those things, classroom management becomes so much easier because kids have exactly what they need and classroom management then becomes community building, which would be a totally different skill, but something teachers are already good at. So again, that vibe check, just building those human-centered educations to kind of arrive at that destination. And I think it will all come together. Like you said, it'll land somewhere in the middle. And yeah, we just have to steer it to kind of an ethical place where people don't become displaced professionally and kids don't fall through the cracks.
Rebecca, I love your answer because you just gave a really simplified layman's terms of disrupting every single element in the operating model. Classroom practitioner to learning architect, moving away from traditional word of school to a network, moving away from a traditional school building classroom to a physical hub, challenging the assessment model, moving away from the perseveration of degrees to credentials. That's all 22nd century. That's where we're going. And Rebecca, your explanation goes back to my essential question. How do we get there? If that's what we know, if this is what we know of my kid, he was thriving. I mean, he's a very, very smart kid thriving in school now, but exponentially, because he's like that. He wants to run around, really want to explore, does his best thinking at selective times. We have to think about how we're going there, right? And it kind of bodes into the next question, Rebecca, is if we're talking about a model where there's our practitioners are learning architects, that right there is a comprehensive redesign of pre-service programs. When we talk about this whole credentials and physical hubs and networks, where do you see now in education today, even in the AC stage of education, where there are vulnerabilities for disruption, for AI disruption, right? And how should we do that, right? What does that look like? Because do we exploit the vulnerabilities for AI? I mean, where do you think this leads to, Rebecca?
I think the things most vulnerable to AI disruption are the things everyone is trying so desperately to protect and hang on to. So standardized testing, traditional grading, homework as we know it, the college application essay. Like it's all about to get absolutely cooked, just to borrow another phrase from Gen Z and Alpha. But and the people who are fighting so hard to keep things as is are the ones who are basically fighting for their own irrelevance. So I think most vulnerable, standardized testing, ACTs, SAT, state assessments, like they're dead institutions walking. Like AI can score 100% on these. And really, they're testing your ability to perform like a machine. We don't need humans who can perform like a machine anymore. We have machines that can perform like humans. It's all theater. And by 2030, any company still using like bubble standardized testing, so I think it'll be like fax machines. I really think it will be. I think traditional homework, the way we know it, that people are still kind of hanging on to, the take-home essay, like we are trying so hard to like catch kids cheating and you know, prove that they cheated. And they can take a picture of their homework and have AI do their homework for them, right? The way that we've always done homework like that, that can't happen. It's basically prompting practice for kids. Teachers just have to assume AI is going to touch every single take-home assignment. Like, you're just teaching kids to be better at using ChatGPT and not get caught, rather than teaching them exactly what you're trying to teach them. So, like, that's totally vulnerable. Gatekeeping this industrial context, like, complex, this idea that we've hung on to, and you and I, again, benefited from this, I'm sure, Michael, but, like, AP courses, honor rolls, class rankings. It's this artificial scarcity we've built into education for, you know, that saying, you know, if you tell a fish he's smart by gauging his ability to climb a tree, he'll live his whole life thinking that he's dumb. We just happen to fit the mold. And so that gatekeeping complex, I think it's got to go. I think we're limiting kids for life by making them think that if they don't fit into this box, I think that's got to go, this gatekeeping. You know, we just have to recognize there'll be lots of different ways to do things. And anything that's like one size fits all, anything has got to go. Textbooks, pacing guides, curriculum maps that all assume kids learn the exact same way. Learning paths. If you think about even the word learning path, that assumes there is one way to get from A to B, and it's along the path. And if you're not very far along the path, you're behind, right? Like you're out of the norm, but you still have to get there following this path. We don't necessarily say learning paths. It will make it look like we're still trying to teach everybody Latin, you know, like the school's clinging to everybody turn to page 47. It's like cosplaying education at this point. Like it's, that stuff is all vulnerable. I think the biggest thing that's vulnerable is ego. I might get heat for saying this, but the teacher who really just wants to teach the same curriculum 25 times and then collect a pension. The administrator whose whole identity is maintaining standards of excellence or keeping everybody in line and checking all the boxes. The parents who think that their school education needs to look exactly the way that theirs did. The truth is AI doesn't care about your comfort zone. And Gen Alpha definitely doesn't. Like, they don't. They're, like you said, they're doing things their way. But there'll be things that thrive, you know. Teachers who are good at creating senses of belonging and connecting with kids and inspiring them. Coaches who see potential in kids before they see it in themselves. I have a kid like that too. Counselors who notice that somebody's struggling, you know, who kind of can see that. AI can't necessarily do those things. You see on TikTok, those principals that know every kid's name and story or has like a secret handshake with every kid that gives them that sense of importance and belonging. That stuff will thrive. That's the stuff. That's what I think is vulnerable and stuff that I think will thrive.
Rebecca, I think that everything you stated within your answer is pivotal for 22nd century design. A lot of that is represented in a very sequential and simplistic way of alignment to various indicators within my 22nd century systems learner framework, specifically really articulating learning paths. I've always been saying that. And thank you for reiterating what I'm saying in much of an easier context for my audience to be able to understand it. But Rebecca, you know, you engage with many leaders, right? And you know, and I know, we have Generation Z will be formally matriculating out of the PK-12 continuum at the conclusion of the 25-26 academic year. So we will have a vertical thread of all Generation Alpha students. That's including my son, who's in fifth grade, he's in fifth grade now. Wow, okay, time flies. But when you think about Generation Alpha, and then in less than 3 years, we're welcoming Generation Beta, into the model. And you're talking about all of these innovative, disruptive elements that need to be ingested into the operating model or incorporated into teaching and learning, instruction and leadership. What advice would you give me if I was a leader regarding your two top recommendations for preparing my system, my organization to be AI driven?
I would say the first one would be set up permission to fail infrastructure. You know, the obvious answers are build AI literacy, create policies. That's like table stakes. That's like saying learn to read and have rules, but build a permission to fail infrastructure. Stop trying to get it right. You won't. The technology is moving too fast. You're just trying to build a static solution for a technology that's always evolving. Give people permission to fail and experiment. Have people share their failures and make it safe. Design sunset clauses. Like, look at every aspect of what you do and decide if it's still relevant. Every AI tool, like every regular tool, every policy, and promote or lift up the people who fail and share about it openly, not the ones who play it safe. Have a best failure award. Like, encourage people to fail and learn. Like, we don't do that great with our kids sometimes, and we definitely don't do that great as adults. But the way that I learned how to use this technology, when it first came out and there was nobody around who could tell me how it worked except for computer science guys who could not explain it to me in regular language. And so I just had to figure it out, and I just started sharing publicly all the ways that it had failed and what I learned. And we both know you learn more from your failures than your success. So create a culture of safety where people can experiment and fail. Because this is the thing, Michael, and you'll see this too. My Gen Z kids, and you're probably Gen Alpha kid, they teach you something. They don't expect perfection. They expect iteration. If your version 1.0 sucks, cool, ship 1.1 tomorrow. And they do a fix and a bug workaround. And that's the energy we need in education. That's what kids expect. Oh yeah, I tried that version. They just released an update, a patch, a fix. It didn't work. Cool. How are they going to fix it? That's the mentality. It's not like for us, oh no, I failed that test. My life is over, right? Like, so they expect iteration and failure. So like, let's make it safe for them. Let's make it safe for us. The second one is a little less, more unorthodox, but I really think we need to have student shadow boards. And hear me out, not student councils, not focus groups. I think match every adult board member at a school with two students, one who's like a tech nerd and the other one who's like, doesn't like the technology. And every AI proposal that goes before the board also goes to a student shadow board. I think maybe you pay them, not in pizza. I think maybe you teach them that their inputs are valuable. You have them evaluate the technology and tell you honestly, and they'll take it seriously if you give them the responsibility, and have them help design your acceptable use policy. Because guess what? Kids know how they're going to use these tools to cheat. They know. And if you can incentivize them to work with you instead of just trying to make all the decisions for them about things that we do not understand, but they do, I think it will kill expensive AI initiatives that make no sense in real world stuff. It will help board members better understand it. And it would make kids part of a conversation they really should be in more anyway. It's one thing to be a student council president and plan dances, but if you're actually advising people in leadership and showing them the AI and how kids are going to use it or what they're saying about it, they know. I think that's a huge thing we're missing. So I think these recommendations do two things that matter. I think they make change safe, and they make students partners instead of recipients. And I think that that combination is how you kind of adopt AI safely and collaboratively, which I think is the goal. Every other recommendation, like literacy, training, policies, those are necessary, but I don't think they're enough. I think those two suggestions create a culture where everything else works. I think it lays the foundation for everything else. So,
absolutely. No, Rebecca, great. I love your two recommendations. Student shadow boards, I love it. I tell you, that's why I love your thinking, man. You're such an innovator with that. We just imagine if we had about 45% of the ecosystem that's disruptive, which is changed the whole trajectory of education. But setting up permission to fail, right? And I love that, because I think that, you know, when I listen to my son when he plays his game, Roblox, and he's playing with people across the world, across the United States, it's just fascinating that they have that in their hand. They're going through multiple iterations of what they're doing for that specific task in that game. And they have multiple ample opportunities to be able to do that. And I see them collectively thinking, I see them having shared experiences. I see them, you know, going through these really divergent experimentations within the game. So absolutely needs to be emulated in the classroom and needs to happen with our teachers and leaders with these tools and with these advanced technologies. Rebecca, we need to see more of that. It's okay to fail. Right? Iterative and dynamic with that. And yes, Rebecca, I was one of those students that, no!
I know, same, right? Like it was the end of the world. And this group isn't like that.
Nah, they are so not. And I could tell you, my son, he goes, oh, okay. And he looks at me, I'm like, dude, but never mind. Last question, Rebecca. And I try to limit my audience to three words, but take this question as it is, because I don't know how I'll be able to hold down Rebecca Boltzmann to three words, but
I picked three. I have three.
You have three. Okay. Let's see if you're a rule follower. What three words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regards to AI and the learner attributes of Generation Alpha and Generation Beta for future readiness?
All right. Number one, curious. They are curious. Everything they learn today will probably be like obsolete by the time they graduate, a lot of it. And so I've learned this from my kids. They don't memorize anything. They just stay curious enough to figure out how to figure it out again when they need to. We're forcing them to memorize stuff. They're not retaining it. They're just figuring out how to solve problems. They'll figure out how to get around the AI detector so that they can do that again later. That's like their takeaway. In a world where AI knows everything, the competitive advantage, I think, isn't knowing, it's wondering and it's curiosity. And the kid who asks, but what if we're wrong about this? What if this doesn't work? Like, those are the kids who will thrive. I think they are inherently curious, which makes them good at AI because they're like, oh, I wonder if it can do this. I wonder if it can do this. And so they're curious. The second one is unimpressed. I think it's my favorite. They are unimpressed by technology. They're not intimidated. They're not obsessed. They're unimpressed. They look at like ChatGPT like I look at calculators, right? Useful tool, nothing more. They're not dazzled like we are. They're not scared. Some of them don't even like it. Oh, it can write an essay. Cool. Like, what else? And so they are tough to impress. The moment you're too impressed by technology, you stop questioning it. And I think that's what is happening a lot in our generation. We're like, oh, cool, it can do this and this. We're just going to trust it. But they're unimpressed, and so they question it. And I like that. I think we need to stay unimpressed. I think we need to stay humble and unimpressed and going with their eyes wide open, which they do. They try something out and they're like, I'm waiting for, you know, version 2, or it's fine, but it doesn't run their lives. Like, none of my kids are as obsessed with ChatGPT as I am because it's so new and shiny to me. But this is a generation that grew up with technology that's all kind of new and shiny. And so they're unimpressed, really. They're unimpressed with everything, which I think is kind of a benefit. I think this one's kind of I don't know. It feels a little too generic, but this idea, like, that yes, they're human, but they're like all about like being human, right? Like, the more artificial everything in their sphere becomes, they care more about things being human and authentic. So, and they realize they're going to have to be aggressively, unapologetically, authentically human in everything they do. And they kind of lean into those messy feelings. And, you know, they'll use AI for homework, but then they'll like spend forever making like a TikTok, you know, that only 7 people will see or understand. And they're doing it more to like human connection with other people on TikTok, not necessarily get seen by the algorithm. So the kids, I think they realize that the people who are going to stand out aren't the ones who are going to be generic and more machine-like. They're going to be the ones who are messy and authentically human. We saw that kind of with TikTok, this move from Instagram, where there was one of the criticisms was, is it just showed everyone's best perfect version of their lives, right? Their highlight reel, a perfectly clean house, while meanwhile, there's laundry baskets of junk off camera. And TikTok just went to like people just filming videos, like sitting on the toilet sometimes, you know, and that kind of messy human authenticity is what made TikTok popular, that relatability. So I think the words that describe me are like curious and unimpressed and like authentically human. So I think that's kind of their survival strategy too. In their careers, I think they're going to need all of those things to kind of survive. And I think those things are how you stay human and humble in an era of godlike technology that's kind of creeping into every aspect of being. I think that they'll be, we also need to be thinking about what words our current system discourages. Like if you think about it, our current school system discourages sometimes things like messy authenticity and humanness and, you know, things like being okay to fail. And so we just need to look at what these kids are. If you're unimpressed, that's not going to fly in today's school system, but that's how these kids are. How do we adapt the school system, the education system to meet these kids where they are and with the things they care about? And our current system isn't designed to accommodate that. So.
Right, right. And Rebecca, one word that is going to stay with me forever now. You already have cognitive offloading, so you already, you know, impacted my IP for that, but stay unoppressed. I love it. Miss Rebecca Baltzma, thank you for coming on Voices for Excellence. If any of my audience, they want to get in contact with you or even extend on our conversation, how would they be able to do that?
I'm on LinkedIn fairly often. I post there every day just talking about the things that we're talking about right now. Or I have a website that's RebeccaBoltzma.com that people can contact me on. But I'm always happy to have conversations talking about my favorite thing to talk about. So thank you for giving me the chance to talk about my favorite thing to talk about, Mike.
Well, Rebecca, thank you for coming on. I'm very appreciative, like I said. And you probably saw my head down a lot when you were talking because you know me. Collecting notes, 2 pages of it, Rebecca. So thank you for today. Thank you for my audience. And absolutely, you're just a remarkable individual within the ecosystem that is bringing the needed capacity, specifically about how we reimagine and reauthor schools for tomorrow. Today, but for tomorrow. So thank you for coming on VFE, Rebecca.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.